Hello everyone, my name is Elijah Davis, minister of the 12th Hour Apostolic Sabbatarian Congregation, Mount Zion, 12th Hour, in the Liberty Hill, Texas. Today is July 2, 2016, or the 28th day of the 4th month, 2020. We will start our first service on this Sabbath day with a song entitled, The Love of Yah. The love of Yah is greater far than counterpent can ever tell. It goes beyond the highest star and reaches to the lowest hell. The guilty pain, bowed down with care, Yah gave His Son to win. His saving charm He reconciled and pardoned from His sin. The love of Yah, rich and pure, measureless and strong, it shall forevermore endure the saints and angels' song. When holy time shall pass away, and earthly throne and kingdoms fall, when men who hear refuse to pray, on our rocks and hills and mountains call, Yah's love so sure shall still endure, all measureless and strong, redeeming grace unto Adam's ray, the saints and angels' song. The love of Yah, rich and pure, how measureless and strong, it shall forevermore endure, the saints and angels' song. Could we beneath the ocean fill, and through the skies the postman made, where every star on earth did quill, and every man ascribed the shame, to write the love of Yah above, to drain the ocean dry, not to the scroll contain the whole, to stretch from sky to sky. The love of Yah, rich and pure, measureless and strong, it shall forevermore endure, the saints and angels' song. Part 7, Behold, I Make All Things New. And we're reading from the White House Recruiter, believe it or not, but I wanted to keep on with the title, Behold, I Make All Things New. Keep that in our minds. We sure need to do that. It says, I want to read to you. Let's get back to original format. Things happen sometimes, unexpected. I had the phone ring. I had a call into Alan DeLong. I was impressed to put a call into him. And he called me as I started my sermon here, and I was going to read Numbers 24. We picked up our conversation on something else, and I had read this morning from Brother Johnson's tract Jubilee, 1998. I just read the first sentence, and then that's all I was told to read. It says, Brother Johnson says, calling the very elect the chosen ones of Israel. If you are truly a Davidian, one, and he's talking to the Adventists now, one who believes that Vitihara was a true prophet, if you believe that the shepherd rod was a message of inspiration, then you will take heed to the special message that Brother Harloff left for the Davidians. That is, and I quote, a Davidian is one who followeth on and on into the newly revealed truth. And then I stopped. Alan DeLong called me at that time, and I read that to him. He said, well, he said, you didn't follow on with me and Sharon, so it shows you're not a true Davidian. I said, no, let's back up. I said, Yahweh says, I will raise from the midst of your brethren like unto me, someone like unto me. Him you must hear in all things. He said, I will raise up a prophet from the midst of thee. And I said, you know, he raised me up in the midst of Gilead Center in 2002. Yeah, but you didn't have no message. I said, I sure did. I had a message from heaven. And I gave it to him. Who was it? I said, repent. Alan, he couldn't say nothing. I said, isn't that enough? If you're told to repent, it means that you've been doing something wrong, that you need to repent of it and change your course. So we had about an hour conversation after that, and now I'm back to where we started our sermon. And I learned an awful lot from Alan DeLong and his apostasy. I need to know a few things, and so he has a way of revealing those things to me that I need to know, that he's not aware of that I need to know. And he gets caught in a trap every time. And these people they wiggle out of it though, because there's a lot of fast talking and meaningless words. They wiggle out of their traps even though they know they've been caught. But they try to wiggle out of it. And so anyway, we're going to suspend with that and go right on into our main study, Numbers chapter 24. And when Balaam saw that it pleased Yahweh to bless Israel, he went not as at other times to seek for the enchantment. But he set his face toward the wilderness. And Balaam lifted up his eyes, and he saw Israel abiding in his tents, according to their tribes, and the Spirit of Yahweh came upon him. And he took up his parable, and said, Balaam the son of Beor hath said, and the man whose eyes are open hath said. He has said, which heard the words of Yahweh, which saw the vision of the Almighty, fallen into a trance, but having his eyes open. How goodly are thy tents, O Jacob, and thy tabernacles, O Israel. As the valleys are, they spread forth as gardens by the river's side. As the gardens are, they spread forth as the gardens by the river's side. As the trees of the lean aloes, which the Yahweh hath planted, and as cedar trees beside the waters. He shall pour the water out of his buckets, and his seed shall be in many waters. And his king shall be higher than Agag, and his kingdom shall be exalted. Elohim brought him forth out of Egypt. He hath, as it were, the strength of a unicorn. He shall eat up the nations, his enemies, and shall break their bones and pierce them through with his arrows. He couched, he lay down as a lion and as a great lion. Who shall stir him up? Blessed is he that blesses thee, and cursed is he that curses thee. And Balak's anger was kindled against Balaam. And he smote his hands together, and Balak said unto Balaam, I call thee to curse mine enemies. And behold, thou hast altogether blessed them of these three times. Therefore now, O flee thou to thy place, I thought to promote thee unto great honor, but lo, the Yahweh hath kept thee back from honor. Only Yahweh can honor anybody here on earth. And here is a deluded king, of a heathen king. He thinks that he's exalted above the Yahweh of heaven. And Balaam said unto Balak, Spake I not also unto thy messengers, which thou sendest unto me, saying, If Balak would give me his house full of silver and gold, I cannot go beyond the commandment of the Yahweh, to do either good or bad of mine own mind. But what the Yahweh says, that will I speak. Behold, I go unto my people. Come therefore, and I will advertise thee what this people shall do to thy people in the latter days. Okay, pay attention to that now. And he took up his parable and said, Balaam, the son of Beor, has said, and the man whose eyes are open has said. He has said, which heard the words of Yahweh and knew the knowledge of the Most High, which saw the vision of the Almighty falling into a trance, but having his eyes open. I shall see him, but not now. I shall behold him, but not now. There shall come a star out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel. Now this star is Yahshua. The scepter is the rod. He's going to have a message called the rod. The rod is going to represent the lawgiver, the authority for Yahweh's government to be restored. Shall rise out of Israel and shall smite the corners of Moab and destroy all the children of Seth. And Edom shall be a possession. Seir also shall be a possession for his enemies. And Israel shall do valiantly. Out of Jacob shall come he that shall have dominion, and shall destroy him that remaineth of the city. And when he looked on Amalek, he took up his parable and said, Amalek was the first of the nation, but his latter end shall be that he perish forever. And he looked on the Kenites and took up his parable and said, Strong is thy dwelling place, and thou puttest thy nest in a rock. Nevertheless, the Kenites shall be wasted, until Asher shall carry thee away captive. And he took up his parable, and said, Alas, who shall live when the Yahweh doeth this? And ships shall come from the coast of Chittim, and shall afflict Asher, and shall afflict Eber, and he also shall perish forever. And Balaam rose up and went and returned unto his place, and Balak also went his way. So what did we learn there? We learned that what Yahweh has commanded, man cannot go beyond that. He can't go beyond it. To do either good or bad of his own mind. But whatever the Yahweh says, that will I speak. Now this is where I stand today. I have my marker out there as counterfeiting the truth. And the only way you counterfeit the truth is he has to first know the truth in order to counterfeit it. And he doesn't realize that that's what he's doing. But he at one time knew the truth. And that's the way you can counterfeit it, is you have to at one time have known the truth. Alright, how do people take the American $100 bill and counterfeit it? They have to have the original. They have to follow it as close as they can, but they can never duplicate it. Because they don't have the original place that the original was made on. They have to make up their own, and they cannot duplicate the original by trying to produce a counterfeit. It has to be similar, very close like him, but not the same. That's what we have when we have people that come in, learn the truth, follow it for a few years, and then get up and walk away from it and say, well, I have new life. I'm going to start my own church, and I'm going to set up my own kingdom, and I'm going to set up my own interpretation of the truth, because I have a lead on a new name called Yasha and Yasharon, and I can't prove it from the prophetic history or biblical history. I can't prove it to be the actual truth, but nevertheless, the inspiration has told me that this is the truth, and that this is the truth that has been hidden from the foundation of the world, but now in these last days has been known to just one or two people, and then they got to take and get this information out to 9-10 billion people on planet Earth. Truth has been hid from the foundation of the world for 6,000 years. It's now got to come to the light, and it's got to be shown. And that truth is a new name, sacred name. Now, how ridiculous is that? How are you going to teach the plan of salvation through just a sacred name only? That's stupid and asinine to think about, and it's not even worth repeating, so I'm not going to repeat it no more. I'm just going to get over to my main study now. We're on track number... we're just on miscellaneous track here. We've got the White House Recruiter, 1951, V.T. Hunter. We're left off on page 9. And we're just going to pick up where we left off from our last study. We've still got the same title. And we're going to... This is part 7. And it says that... Let's do a little review, though, from what we've recorded on our last tape, the last end of this study. Well knowing, as we do, the answer to these urgent questions... All right, let's back up a little further. Arise, shine, for thy light is come, and the glory of the Yahshua is risen upon thee. For behold, the darkness shall cover the earth, and gross darkness the people, but the Yahshua shall rise upon thee, and his glory shall be seen upon thee, and the Gentiles shall come to thy light, and kings to the brightness of thy rising. Isaiah 60, verse 3. Now, how does this translate into anything meaningful today, that we can tangibly place a finger on and say, this is how this applies today? Well, number one, the earth and prophecy is the United States, okay? And when it says, arise, shine, for thy light is come, who is this thy? The house of David. And your light is to shine in the 12th hour and close out the sixth hour. The sixth seal. And bring the judgment of the dead to a close, 2002, Kermit, Texas. So it says, arise, shine, house of David, for thy light is come, and the glory of the Yeshua is risen up on thee. So when the sun went down at the end of the 11th hour, at Kermit, Texas, closing out Mount Zion at the 11th hour, with Willis Johnson at the helm, what does he tell the new people that's waiting there in the marketplace to be hired to take up their work anew in the morning to start the 12th hour? What is their message? It says, thy light is come. What do you mean, thy light? In other words, the new truth that you have with that extra oil in your, and that extra container that you have, representing the five wise virgins, that you picked up during the 11th hour. Now, the light for the 11th hour is going out, because they don't have a container of their own with extra oil in it. And their light is going out because they don't have any extra oil. And they can only continue so far with the oil in their lamp directly. And it's getting very low. So he's telling these here 12th hour laborers, the one that's called at the end of the 11th hour, that's in the marketplace. He says, now arise. What does it mean, arise? It means it's time to get up. You've been sleeping all night. It's time to get up. Arise, get up out of bed. The sun's coming up. He said, and shine. When does the sun shine? The sun can only shine when it comes up over the horizon. So he says, now these new laborers, this fifth group of laborers are found in Matthew 20, verse 6, that's called at the end of the 11th hour, arise, shine, thy light, for thy light is come. So guess what? The house of David then represents the sun coming up. And shine this light upon the unfolding of prophecies. Okay, arise, shine, for thy light is come, and the glory of the Yahweh, heaven, Yahshua, all of heaven, is risen upon thee. For behold, the darkness shall cover the earth, and in gross darkness the people, but the Yahshua shall arise upon thee. And his glory shall be seen upon thee. And the Gentiles shall come to thy light, and kings unto the brightness of thy rising. Isaiah 60, verse 1 to 3. In the power of praise, rule or ruin, war bent and hell bent, self destructive force of mankind, and the anger and catastrophic upheavals and outbreakings of the elements of nature, and in the accumulating fulfillment of the fast unfolding prophecies in the word of Yahweh, the signs of the times thunder, the warning appeal that we arise in Elohim's light and make haste to rescue his people from the ills which threaten to devastate the world. If such is not the church's great mission and duty at this crisis hour, what need then do the Yahshua and the world have of her? For what can the church do unless her members, both lay and clerical, arise together as one man and throw their all into the conflict? They all rise as one unit, see, as one man. Well knowing as we do the answer unto these urgent questions, what excuse will we have if we do not now arouse ourselves and all saints in the Christendom along with us to do what the gospel commands us to do? Regardless how dramatic and impressive any demonstrations the church may put on, it is no secret that even if she is not pushed out of any place or country, still at her present pace of preaching the gospel of the kingdom, a temporal millennium will not suffice her in which to warn the world. In other words, give her her own 1,000 years to be in charge of and represent a temporal kingdom. Give her 1,000 years, it will not suffice her in which to warn the world. Finish her work and bring a kingdom in. What is that kingdom at? The everlasting kingdom of David. And every enlightened mind knows this to be the inevitable truth. Alright, now we're back to where we just left off yesterday. Just look at the brute predatory forces loose and lurking everywhere, and causing the whole earth to erupt with violence, tumult, and terror. Verily, they are making men's hearts to fail them for fear, and for looking after those things which are coming on the earth. Luke 21:26. Will not all Christians everywhere be aroused by these things to put on the whole armor of Yahweh, and to take the sword of the Spirit, Ephesians 6:11-17, while following Yahshua as he leads ahead? If not, then certain it is that the church and the world as well are hopelessly doomed. To be sure, though, the few who do arouse to make the total surrender that the hour demands, Elohim will save from the conflagration to come. Okay. How, though, shall he deliver anyone who fails to heed the signs of the time? the thunderings of the dead drums of the doomsday, now flashing in our eyes and rumbling in our ears, with warning more awful than the flaming thunders of the Sinai. No, he could no more deliver such spiritually blind, deaf, and dumb incurables than he could have delivered the antediluvians who failed to go into Noah's Ark. And now, what do the flying saucers add to the already grim picture? Whether they are earth-produced mechanisms, or celestial and planetary spaceships, they paint still grimmer the picture for the sinner. One may be incredulous, another startled at the thought of the heavens flying saucers, but why? Fellaham has given man knowledge to develop aerial mechanisms. No one can reasonably suppose that heaven does not have an incomparably superior one. Let us not forget what covered a whole mountain in Elisha's day, 13:6-17. To be sure, Elisha called them chariots, but if they were not flying saucers of some type, how did they come to the earth? It matters not what one calls them. It's what they are and what they do that count. Be they what they may, however, the signs round about us unmistakably warn that thick black clouds warn that thick black clouds the globe around are considering are consolidating to pour down upon a shelterless world the most horrific storms since time began. Unto all who have an ear to hear and an eye to see, the signs of times reveal that we are fast coming face to face with a time of trouble such as never was Daniel 12:1. Well, we're at that place. We are in the throes and the beginning of that time and place. A clear grasp of the terrible potential. Okay, of the weapons now available can leave no doubt of the global peril in the picture. Every one of us knows that if the flying saucers are secret military weapons of the United States, then other nations besides ourselves will soon have them too, if they do not have them already. If so, what then can they be designed for but to snuff out the lies, even the lies of the elect if possible? If the flying saucers are indeed the Yahshua's, then what else are they come for but to deliver everyone whose name is found written in the book, Daniel 12:1, and to slay those who oppress them, Isaiah 66:16. Or if perchance none of the heavens are yet come, still, nothing is more certain than that the day hastens greatly when they will come. What is of the first and supreme importance to each, however, is to know for a surety that his name is written in the book. To have this most blessed assurance, one must first know what will keep one's name out of the book and what will put it in. One of the many things that will keep one's name out of the book of Elohim is one's turning a deaf ear to the Yeshua's warning that he who puts his hand to the plow and looks back, he who starts in the gospel work and turns away from it, is not fit for the kingdom. Luke 9:62. For the fact is that all who have graduated from ministerial colleges have already put their hand to the plow. Will they now turn back? We devoutly hope not. So here's Vicky Olive clinging to the Mother Church, clinging to her apron strings. And she's saying, I'm just a child, and you're my mother. And he's pleading with Mama to accept new truth that's unfolding. But he's always addressing it as we. Not them and us, but we. because when you move on to a new feeding pasture, and those in the old feeding pasture don't follow you into the new feeding pasture, then it becomes them, not we. Them is a pronoun for those left behind that wouldn't come into the next feeding pasture. And then we, Beatty-Hollis, instead of using that pronoun we to include the Adventists and the Davidians together, it doesn't, that's not the way it's supposed to be applied. The we belongs to the Davidians, because the them, the Adventists, have been cut off. If they didn't accept the new truth, I just read it to you from Bertus W. Johnson quoting Beatty-Hollis. At the beginning of this sermon, he said, a Davidian is one who follows on and on into the newly revealed truth. So, the Adventists got a new name in 1930. Seventh-day Adventist to a Davidian Seventh-day Adventist. So a true Davidian are the ones that came out of the Adventist church into the second feeding pasture Carmel. That's why they got the new name. House of David was born in 1930. That concept of identifying the House of David in the Adventist Church was born. It was born with the prophecy of Ezekiel 4 in 1890 with Jones and Wagner. Jones and Wagner gave birth to the House of David, a prophecy that pointed out the House of David was the next thing on the scene after the Adventists were through. Seventh-day Adventists was only represented by the 10 tribes that resided in the north. That's the reason why their symbol is the bear that dwells in the north. The Seventh-day Adventist symbol is the bear. The Davidian Seventh-day Adventist symbol is the lion in the south. That right there alone, that prophecy right there alone separates the house of David from the house of the 10 tribes. The bear and the lion. What did David do when he was a little shepherd boy? He slew those two symbols in his day that represented the latter day house of David. Now keep in mind, David out there herding the sheep, the little lambs, and the grown ones, he represented the house of David. Well, who did that bear represent? That bear represented the Seventh-day Adventist Church, the mother church that David came out of. And who was David's father? Jesse. And Jesse is a symbol today in the allegory of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Okay? So David came out of Basham, the Seventh-day Adventist Church today, as he did in the time. His father Jesse was a symbol of the Seventh-day Adventist Church today. David was out herding the sheep for his father, Mama, Dathan, Jesse. And a bear came out that was a symbol of the house of Israel, 10 tribes. And he took a lamb out of David's flock. Now what does that tell you? He came in and tried to steal one of David's converts, one of the members of his flock. The bear came out of another region. He came out of another pasture. And he comes in and intrudes into David's domain, unannounced, uninvited. He come in to plunder, to steal, and to create mayhem and destroy. And David says, no, nothing doing, nothing doing. You're not getting away with that. And the bear says, well, I'm bigger and stronger and I can kill you with a swipe of the paw. In other words, David says, no, nothing doing, nothing doing. He says, I have the spirit of Yahweh upon me. I'm superior than you in all your strength. I know I have the greatest strength in the world, because I have the anointing of the Spirit. David, knowing this, he wasn't afraid to tackle any enemy. He went after the bear and slew the bear, caught a bear and slew him with his own bare hands. Then after that, here comes a lion. That represents the South Country. Judah. That's where David was, from the tribe of Judah. Now here comes a symbol of an animal that represents David's kingdom. And that lion says, I'm in charge. What did the Davidians say today when the first Davidian pastor, Carmel, represented by the lion? What did Ben Roden say when Vicki Hollis died? He said, I am representing the line of the tribe of Judah. Nothing doing. I'm not giving in to you, Verlis W. Johnson. Verlis Johnson was his successor. And so, here comes this lion out of Carmel. Ben Roden one day, he came into the feeding pasture of Gilead to Verlis W. Johnson. He says, give me that creation counter. I'm in charge of the kingdom, not you. He said, I'm the one, only one entitled to produce that creation counter. Brother John says, not so. The Yahweh gave it to me. Not you. I'm holding on to it. And then Brother Johnson held on to it until Yahweh told him to give it up and to the real David, the real true David. And it's typically Elijah David speaking to you right now. And Elijah David says, give it up. And lo and behold, well, the lion says, no, I want to take a lamb out of your flock. And so that was the Gilead Center. Brother Johnson representing that lion that came into David's lair and took a lamb out. David said, nothing doing. You're not stealing my converts. You're not stealing my sheep. And he went out after him in the name of the Yahweh. And the spirit and power of Yahweh, and he slew that lion. So when he slew that lion, that represented the Adventist church and the Davidian Adventists coming to their close forever here on earth, as far as having anything to do with perpetuating and forwarding the gospel of the three angels' messages, for that's all they had. The whole feeding pastures of Bashan, Carmel, and Gilead, that's really all they had, was the three angels' messages during the judgment of the dead. That was devoid of the outpouring of the Holy Spirit in the Antitype. Because when you have the outpouring of the Holy Spirit in the Antitype, then you're represent a purified kingdom, and you're with a new message, with a new leader, and in a new hour, parabolic hour. That's who we are today. So Rhoda Steffi Johnson, he tried to come out of the 11th hour. He tried to come over into the 12th hour, and he tried to steal the little lambs out of the house of David in the 12th hour while he was yet in the 11th hour. Whole feeding pasture that had already been closed up and rejected by Yahweh and Yahshua. So he closed up that prophecy and that allegory and that parable of David slaying the bear and the lion in one day. One day, Gilead Center, those two symbols representing the Adventist and the Davidian Seventh-day Adventist came to an end. And this is essentially what I told our brother Alan DeLong this morning on the phone, and he just almost went into a rage denying it. All right, let us go ahead. He says, the issue is of the greatest gravity. Yahshua foreknow. And here it got foreknow, it would. It's supposed to be foreknew that it would. I'll tell you this terrible, terrible grammar by all these writers. I don't care if you're looking at the news. I don't care if you're looking at all the Adventist writers. Sister White has got the best writing in the word fiction I've ever read. She's the most readable. And she's 50% verb fiction. But nevertheless, she had a gift that was legible. And even though I have to rearrange 50% of her writings when I'm reading it, and if I want to be 100% legible, I have to rearrange 50% of hers. But that's okay. I just gloss over it so many times, don't pay no attention to it, because it's understandable like it is, so I just go ahead and let it stand. I don't try to get so technical all, on every point, but the thing is, I'm trying to say, just like right here, Vijayada is saying, the issue is greatest gravity. Well, I said, here's where he should have written it. For the issue is of the greatest gravity. For the Yashua foreknew or is with the foreknowing that it would be of the greatest gravity. Now, if he wanted to make sense out of it, for you to understand it fully, that's the way it should have been written. Alright? And in the supreme concern is he projected it in the crowning lesson of his parable of the vineyard. Now that time has come for the last parabolical hour, he has set the parable ablaze with the light. To be progressive as the truth itself is, let us look deeper into the parable now while the light of the Elohim is shining on the parable. Sivi tells us why the light of the Yahweh, or of Yahweh, is shining on it. It is a pronoun. But if you end a sentence with the word parable, that's the noun. You don't ever end a sentence with a pronoun. You can end it with a noun, and all sentences are supposed to end with a noun, unless you're asking a question. And even with a question, you can do that. For the kingdom of the heaven is like unto man that is an householder, which went out early in the morning to hire laborers into his vineyard. And when he had agreed with the laborers for a penny a day, he sent them into his vineyard, and he went out about the third hour and saw others standing idle in the marketplace, and said unto them, go ye also in the vineyard, and whatsoever is right I will give thee you. And they went their way. Again he went out about the sixth and ninth hour and did likewise. And about the 11th hour he went out and found others standing idle, and saith unto them, why stand ye here all the day idle? They say unto him, because no man hath hired us. He saith unto them, go ye also in the vineyard, and whatsoever is right, that shall ye receive. Matthew 20, verse 1 to 7. Now I have some explanation I want to do here at this point on what I just read. Now you can take this 6th, 9th, and the 11th hour two ways. You can take the 6th hour as the beginning of the 6th hour, and what took place at the beginning of the 6th hour, and what took place at the end of the 6th hour. You can deal with that. You can deal with the 9th hour. These are all in the parable Matthew 20 mentioned, 6th, 9th, 11th. But, you know, you never have 9th, 10th, and the 12th mentioned in the parable. You only have 6th, 9th, and 11th. But not 10, not 10 and 12, which is two prophetic hours between those that are called 6th, 9th, and 11th. Now, in the 6th hour call, you have the 7th and the 8th hour sandwiched in between the 9th. But you don't have the 7th and the 8th hour mentioned. You just have the 9th hour mentioned. You don't have the 10th hour mentioned, but you have the next hour, the 11th hour mentioned. But you don't have the last hour, the 12th hour mentioned. So how do you understand which hour is which at the time that they're on time? You have to start and identify when the beginning of these prophetic hours are named. Now, the beginning of the 6th hour was 1810. That was when Alexander Campbell, the 4th reformer coming out of the Dark Ages, was given the doctrine of baptism by the immersion and developed into the Baptist Church, which they call First Day Adventist in 1833. The Sunday-keeping Baptists were eventually progressed into the Millerites, First Day Adventists, and also the Baptists progressed into the Seventh-day Baptists. They kept the Seventh-day Sabbath. So there's two witnesses right there that the Baptist Church was developed by Alexander Campbell starting the 6th hour in 1810. And the 6th hour came to its close in 1833. Now, William Miller was called during the sixth hour in the 1820s, thereabouts, to prepare for his work when the sixth hour was over with. But he was prepared in the sixth hour, just like Yahshua was prepared in his day in the third hour. And when he was hung on the cross, the third hour came to an end. So likewise, William Miller was prepared before the end of the sixth hour. And when the sixth hour came to an end, he was given a new commission to work in the next 3 hours, the next three parabolic hours. So William Miller worked in 4 hours. He worked in the sixth hour, the seventh hour, the eighth hour, and the ninth hour. William Miller worked in 4 parabolic hours. He was called in the sixth hour, and he closed out the sixth hour in 1833 to start the first day of it. Then he worked in the seventh, eighth, and ninth hour, and closed out the ninth hour, and ushered in the seventh day Adventist at the ninth hour, Ellen G. White and the Advent Band, and to work in the tenth parabolic hour. Okay, but the Adventist is also assigned the 11th parabolic hour. So, the Adventist then worked in the 10th and the 11th parabolic hour from 1844 to 2002. So they worked in, they were called in the ninth, at the end of the ninth hour. Ellen G. White was called in the 1840s when the ninth hour was still on. So she was called at the closing of the ninth hour. That's proven by prophecy. And so likewise, when it says, and they went out about the 11th hour, well, it shows right there that those that are standing out on the marketplace was called at the closing of the 11th hour to go to work in the morning to start their work anew in the kingdom. And the kingdom, that was set up at 2 also. See, the 11th hour didn't set up the kingdom. That's the reason why there's some workers standing idle in the marketplace. They had no work to do because the foreman of the vineyard, Phyllis Johnson, he didn't have the commission to bring forth a purified kingdom. So when he saw that he wasn't going to be able to do this, his work just dwindled up and went away. He didn't have no work left for the workers that come looking for new hire. He didn't have no work for them because he didn't have no timber to put another plank in the building. And that would be the 12th hour plank to usher in the kingdom of David. So since he didn't have no new building material, he didn't have no new truth, he didn't have nothing on the horizon to perpetuate and to continue his work, and so therefore it came to an end. Well, I know that's belaboring the point a lot, but you know, these points need to be stressed more and more all the time as they become clear to us here. Alright, so he says, again he went out about the sixth and ninth hour and did likewise. So he went out the sixth hour and he hired William Miller. He went out the ninth hour and he hired Ellen G. White. And he did likewise. And about the 11th hour he went out and hired Elijah David. We're just getting right to the point now. He went out and found others standing idle and saith unto them, why stand ye here all the day idle? Okay. They said unto him, because no man hath hired us. Why? Because there was no man had come to the marketplace looking for laborers. There wasn't any owner of any vineyards that came to the marketplace. That's the reason why the workers were standing idle. They went to the marketplace, but there wasn't anybody there hiring. There wasn't nobody there. Because there wasn't anybody that had any work to do in their vineyard. Their work was all through and over with, and they had no work to do. That's the reason why they said, because no man has hired us. Because there was no man there to hire them. He saith unto them, go ye also into the vineyard, and whatsoever is right, that shall ye receive. So, where's the vineyard at? It's where those former workers were at. So here come some new workers, and they go out to the vineyards, and they go into the vineyards, and the foreman of the vineyard says, "Well, who hired you all? I didn't go to the marketplace and hire you all. What are you doing here?" They said, "Well, a man came along while we were in the marketplace, and he asked us why we were standing idle, and we said, well, no man had come here and hired us." He said, "Well, you go also into the vineyard where they're at." And so they left the marketplace, in other words, they left town. In other words, they left the Seventh-day Adventist Church, because the marketplace is the Seventh-day Adventist Church proper. And so these new laborers that they hired for the, at the end of the 11th hour are the 144,000. That's the reason why they go out of the marketplace at the command of that man that came out of nowhere and asked them why they were standing there idle. They said, "Because no man has hired us." Why did no man hire them? Adventists have always taught for years and years. I know I went to them for years and years and years. And I went to their ministers, and I went to their general conference presidents, and I asked them, "Why aren't you teaching 144,000? "Well, we don't know who they are, and besides, they're not a real number anyway." "No, but they were sure in their ranks and midst waiting to be hired, because they were there for a reason, and you don't even know they're in your midst." That's the reason why those foremen of the vineyard, whenever those 11th hour laborers came to the marketplace to be hired, that's the reason they never went to the marketplace, because they didn't know that there was anybody going to be there, because they didn't know of anybody else. Everybody was working in the vineyard was already there with them. They didn't know that there's going to be new laborers come to the marketplace looking for hire. And who was these new laborers that showed up at the 11th hour? At the time of the 11th hour was coming to a close. Who were they? They were these people that had prepared themselves in the 11th hour in the Adventist Church that are going to come and represent the 144,000. And now they're looking for work. But they're looking for the leaders of the vineyards to give them a description of what their work is to be and where it's to be at. Well, you know, the owner of the vineyard, he knows exactly what work's supposed to be done and where it's supposed to be done at. And these people that come to the marketplace are there for one reason: to find out where do I go work, and so forth. But there was nobody there to give me any direction. But here comes this stranger out of nowhere and asking them, "Why are you standing here idle?" They said, "Well, no man has hired us." He saith unto them, "Go ye also into the vineyard, and whatsoever is right, that shall ye receive." Matthew 20, verse 27. Notice he says, "Go ye also." In other words, it shows that Yahshua had hired laborers before, and they were working in his vineyard, and their time was just about up. But they knew it not. But they knew that they didn't have any more work for anybody else, so they just kept on working their vineyard until it was over with. Yahshua comes along, he says, "There's going to be a new crop, there's going to be a new field open up. I need new laborers." That's when he said, "Go also into that vineyard, because there's going to be some new work to be done, but those that are working there now doesn't know it." So he says, "But you go also into the vineyard, and whatsoever is right, that shall you receive." Whatever is right, and the pay was a penny a day for anybody. So he says, how can we know for a certainty in which hour we find ourselves, and if our own calls or services come? We can know only by establishing the time in which the last parabolic hour expires, and to do this we must first establish the time of the first call for the servants, then in turn, the time of each successive call culminating with the last. First, though, pursuant unto this end, we must bring into focus the parable's significant point. Number one, the householder, as every Bible student knows, is Lord himself, and he's got an upper and lower case, which means Yahshua. Okay, now, the foreman of the vineyard is the one that goes and hires people. Well, a big part of his sin is the Lord himself, so he's saying really it's Yahweh the Father himself. So let's leave it at that. Let's leave the household of being the Father. Let's just see what happens here. I know I've taught that it's Yahshua, and then I've taught it as the Father, and I've taught it as Yahshua. But let's just see what happens if the Father is the household of which he is the first creator of everything. So let's see. Number two, the laborers are his servants. Well, didn't Yahweh send his son Yahshua? Wasn't that his first servant that he sent to set up his vineyard and to be the foreman of the first vineyard of the house of Israel? Alright. So Yahshua is the first one of the sent of the Father. The laborers are his servants. The penny is a reward. Number four, his vineyard is the place where they are to labor. Number five, the day is parabolical, representing a period of time which is illuminated by some great light. Number six, the period of labor is both preceded and succeeded by a night, else there could be no early and no late part of the day. Number seven, the householder hires laborers at five different times. Number eight, there are 4 3-hour periods, number nine, in each of the first three periods, only one group is hired. Number ten, in the fourth and last period of 3 hours, two groups are hired. Number 11, the agreement for a penny a day is made only with the first group. Number 12, the other groups are to receive whatever is right. Number 13, at the day's end, all are given the same penny, a penny, even though the last work only an hour. Number 14, the first were paid last, the last were paid first. Okay, this brings in verse 36, our contest is at the 11th hour call. That's number 11, click on our audio archives. We're going to close now with a song by Elijah David. Dusty Rhodes and Sandal City. As you well know by now, this is my number one sentimental favorite of all that I've ever written. And if you pay close attention to the words, you'll understand why each time that you hear it.
And don't be his boy, the journey was complete from the men.
me to offer up this story.